Esther Perek Shlishi. Achar HaDivorim Ha'ela. Now that's a very provocative beginning. Once upon a time, not quite. Achar HaDivorim Ha'ela. What is the relationship between everything that had taken place and the fact that Gidal HaMelech HaKashverosh Et Haman Ben Hamdatah HaAgagi Vayinas Eir? There seems to be absolutely no connection between the two. And indeed, the Gemara asserts that the connection is profound, but it's not mechanical, and therefore doesn't read very well from the literary point of view. Achara Devarim Ha'ela means that since HaKadosh Baruch Hu is always borei the refuah lifnei ha-makam, in this case, all parts of the plot that were necessary for achieving the v'nahafachu at the end have been put into place. So that we view the first two prakim as, first of all, the transition and the destruction of Malchut Bavel in Perek Aleph, which was the kiyum of the original vision of Daniel. The second perek is the empowerment of Mordechai and Esther, putting them into a position in which Purim has begun, in which the Melech is now ready to respond at the necessary point, the moment in which that Sefer HaZichronot, the Sefer Divrei HaYamim, Lifnei HaMelech, with which the previous perek ended, and that makes it very dramatic if we see Achar HaDvarim Ha'ela as being a direct continuation of there. Now that Esther is in place, and now that the Ma'amar Mordechai is in place, so that we understand that something has already been put into position, we can now afford to get moving on the Haman angle. So, okay, that's a profound sense of structure in the Sefer. And I mean, we have to recognize that the level of putting things into place are very, very intricate. Putting things into place, I mean, on the one hand, putting things into place ready for a guy like Haman, as we've already seen, is the relationship of Mordechai, who is Ben Kish, who is raising the great-granddaughter of Kish, who is the one that, in the end, causes the birth of Haman through Shaul, and what it is that she is enabled here by just that fantastically beautiful historical hint of L'Re'uta Tova Mimeno, which brings us straight back to L'Re'o HaTov Mimeno, with which Shaul lost because of creating Haman. So we also sense not simply Refuah L'Maka, but we sense the historical positioning of all of the players on the board so that we could start talking about Haman ben Hamdatah Ha'agagi, even though this is hundreds and hundreds of years ago. We skip directly, just as we did with Mordechai, to stress the Kish connection. We flew all the way back now to Ha'agagi to bring us back to exactly the same moment in time so we can sense where the two things are coming together. But we'll see that these issues are also part of the transition between the Memuchan sense. Remember, Memuchan also meant now that everything is set up and ready, so that it's Huchan, and this is now indeed the Hachana for Haman's fall. Well, we already saw he was the one who put Esther into the position, which is going to ultimately destroy him. He was the one who has been making for himself, giving Achashverosh free lien here to do whatever he wants. Whereas up until then, the king would only do lifnei koyudei dat v'din. He wanted to loosen up those reins in order to allow him to be the one that would enable to get the king to do whatever he wanted by making him completely dependent on him with the whole absurd Mikado scene and the Dan Quayle Murphy issue that he brings up, which leaves Achashverosh in a position of being the laughing stock of the world other than for Haman. So, of course, it's that very thing that creates the sense of dependency in Achashverosh afterwards, and that leads him to suspect not only Haman, but Esther, who he believes Haman is the one that's arranged to get in, which, of course, Esther capitalizes on when she says, how about just you and Haman and me getting together, which, of course, speaks directly to his paranoia. I always knew it. They were in cahoots. We wanted Vashti out of the way. Well, of course, all of this now, yes, that's another level, the historical level, the Refuah L'Maka level, the level of Haman as Mumuchan having created his own basis for this whole business. And then But there have been some other Akarhad Dvorim Ha'eles, which are fascinating ones, and that is the clear-cut positioning of women here. In which, and the truth is that the story revolves strongly around the whole idea of women's lib, taken in a completely different direction. Because essentially we have the destruction of the Huyim Sholbach in the way in which Vashti has handled him, which is going to happen in the way Esther completely takes over, not only from her new husband, so to speak, Ahasuerus, but from her old husband, Mordechai, in which up until now everything that he says she's doing, and in the end she simply bosses him around, it gets to the point at which it's just hilarious. All she needs to do is cast a look. And then, of course, we have the story of Zeresh at the end and her impact on Haman, which is also remarkable. So there's three women that are central. Two of those women, amazingly, are interchangeable by the Gemara. Because the Gemara brings out that there were four absolutely insanely stunning women in the world. Now, one of them is Sora, and we've already seen that Sora has everything to do with Esther, weirdly enough. Because, I mean, that weird thing that Rabbi Akiva says when everybody was sleeping in Tafyomi and he wanted to wake them up, so the Gemara says, he said, Ma ra'ata Esther, that she should become queen at 127. Not. That's because Sarah lived for 127 years. And who? What? Who? Even Richie got up for that one and thought that was absolutely wild. It's an old issue. But when we consider, my God, there was only one other instance in history where a husband inserted a woman into a Beit HaMelech, and that's Avram and Sarah. Which is really weird. And indeed, in the Medrash, on the pasuk where Esther, we said the whole Tehillah, Keli, Keli, Lama Azaftani, which, you know, the old Yoshka pasuk, is really the pasuk about Ayelet HaShachar was Esther. So, Lama Azaftani, the Lashon of the Medrash, is Lama Nishtana Alay Sidurosha Olam V'Sidurosha Imahot. Esther, Sora, Imenu, Ayidei Shenishbeit, Laila Achat. What you had to spend with that idiot was one night, and Lakahu V'chol Beito. Shenema V'ayinaga Shemet Paro Negaim Gidolim V'et Beito. So he suffered tremendously from that, and never was able to touch her. Amra Esther, Anina Tanai V'cheko Shelo Torah Shakala Shanim Alolo, this is outrageous. What am I doing here with this guy? Why don't you do me Nisim? Lo Meinata Roseli Nisim. So there really is a strong connection to the Sora. And then we have Rochav and Abigail and Esther. Obviously, there's strange connections there too. But Esther says, but of course, according to Mandioma, that Esther was Yarok Roket. She couldn't have been that beautiful if she was all green. Maybe she looked like a Martian. So then we'd have to take out Esther and insert Vashti instead as being the leading contender for woman number four, who is the most beautiful. That's weird, Vashti and Esther, in terms of... And what's even crazier is we're going to see that the idea of Yirak Roket very much relates to the idea of Mikra. Same letters, which of course is all about Amalek. So Amalek was Asher Korcho Baderech, which is Rashi's Lashon Keri, which is Tuma, which is wastage, which is all about randomness, as Bilam points out. What a crazy way to reproduce, wasting all of those sperm cells to get one, possibly, fertilization. Seems not the way I would do it if I were God, therefore it can't really be God. That was Bilam's idea. Me misparova yisroi, you guys are crazy. God is sitting here watching intercourse because he's waiting for a sperm cell. There's got to be better ways to do it than that if he's really into this. And amazingly, the very next piece of the Gemara says, yes, Rochav, you may know about Rochav. Rochav, all you need to do is say your name and you spontaneously ejaculate. Says, I don't know, I say her name all the time, doesn't do anything to me. Oh, that's because you don't know her. You have to know her. What in the world? It's immediately after the sugya of Esther ben Yirak Roket. Okay, so something strange is going on when you get back to what that strangeness is. But clearly, this is about a change. And you'll remember that if this is the book of Kimu v'Kiblu HaYehudim, then it becomes the absolute opposite of Kabbalat HaTorah, where Al Tikshu Elisha, and the whole point is there can't be any Tumat Keri. That's the whole idea. That's why it's Al Tikshu Elisha, the Shloshi Yamin. And all of a sudden here, the whole thing is about Yirak Roket and Yakar, and Yikar Labalayim, and Keri, the ways that we combine all of those issues into the Lo Davar Reku Mechem, as we'll see, is central to understanding everything that's happening here. Weird things are going on, and we need to see the Achar Devarim Ha'ela as preparation for these weird things. And so first, as the Malma points, it's a gradual thing. First he's Gidal HaMelech HaKashverosh, because this guy was a nobody originally. So you can't suddenly put him all the way up on top. That's why this took years. So first Gidlo. So he turned him into one of the Sarim, where everybody had looked at him as the nut who couldn't spell potato. And then...
Nobody else?
They don't
know.
Vayanas Ehu. Vayanas Ehu is to uplift him. So now he became not just Gidal, but he made him really hot stuff. And then finally, Vayasem et Kiso Mialkola Sarima Sharito. Put him into a position where he was even greater than anyone else. Now, this could be another way of understanding the Achara Dvarim Ha'elu in a more simple literary sense, which is, as some of the Mefarshim suggest, maybe what it was Achara Dvarim Ha'elu was Achashverosh's response to Esther. So now that you have become queen and he tried everything else, maybe you'd be happy. Maybe you don't like parties. Maybe you don't like tax break. Maybe you don't like gifts. But maybe if I show how much I appreciate the guy who put you into position. Maybe that would be something. Okay, it's a pshat, not a very persuasive one. But there is a beautiful medrash that is persuasive. And that is the Achar HaDevarim Ha'ela means that the Melech was trying to get out of the Sefer Divrei HaYomim, Lifnei HaMelech. Because what had happened was, he now realized he's indebted to Mordechai. You think he doesn't know that Mordechai is a member of APEC? Obviously he knows. That was the, so says the Medrash. He says, oh no, now what do? I owe this guy something, and now how am I going to resist his lobbying? There's only one thing I can do. If I take the anti-Beis HaMikdash lobbyist, who is Haman, and I put him into a position, I'll let the two of them cancel each other out while I get some rest from this. So that it was Achar HaDevarim Ha'elu, after falling into the clutches of needing to give something to Mordechai, Gidal HaMelech HaKashverosh, which is very cute. Again, it's not, you know, fundamental kind of shock, but it's definitely cute, because as we've seen all along, this was very, very much on the mind of Achashverosh, trying to please everybody, the everybody being those two people, Kirtzon Ish Ve'ish. The only two people are called Ish, so the Ish Yehudi and Haman HaRab, this is how said the Ish was Haman. So that those two people now are the ones he's trying to please. If we look at it that way, it's got to be some element of that here. V'chol avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech kor'im u'mishtachavim le-haman. Kichon, guys, miss something? V'chol avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech kor'im u'mishtachavim le-haman. They all are to bow down to Haman. Kichen tzivalo ha-melech. This is, normally it's something that you would think would be insulting to the king, that in front of the king, are you in the Shar HaMelech? I understand in other places you're supposed to show homage to the king's ministers, but in the Shar HaMelech, it would certainly not be acceptable. That would be like saying Adoni Yoav in front of David. I mean, that was considered to be a Merida Mamalchus. The only reason it was acceptable here, therefore the pasuk goes out of its way to say that this was the point, Kein Tzivalo HaMelech. But Mordechai lo yichrav lo yishtachaveh. Now, actually, the Alshich learned that that was part of the tzivut. Everybody has to bow down to a Haman, but not Mordechai. So he really set this up. I mean, he knew exactly what he was doing. The only one that doesn't have to respond to Haman is Mordechai. It's an interesting shot, but certainly not the Pashtut. But by doing that, of course, he turned it into a very intense competition, which is central to what happens later with the whole story of, okay, who gets to ride the horse, and the way that Haman is trying to undo Mordechai, and this is the eighth that he was going to be Taila Mordechai, Ashet Yiper Tov Ala Melech. Obviously, there's something there all along in the king's mind, which goes back to the Sefer Divrei HaYomim and the Achar Dvarim Ha'ela. So there's definitely a connection between the two. And it's a connection that runs through the entire book. So it's a brilliant insight, I mean, if you read it this way.
Yeah.
So, but the way the Medrash puts it is, I mean, what, this guy's looking for trouble? I mean, as the Gemara puts it. I mean, this is the guy who almost wipes out Klal Yisrael. And, I mean, the story is in the Gemara. I mean, it's not just that he wouldn't bow down. He infuriated him. Because, according to the Gemara, what's amazing is that Mordechai and Haman were old friends from the army days. So they had been in the same platoon, you see, and had both got caught out in the desert after the rest of the platoon was wiped out. So there they are. Speaking of Gilbert and Sullivan, I mean, this is like the ultimate. So there is Mordechai and Haman in the Persian army, okay?
Where does this come from?
This is the Gemara.
Yeah, this is the Gemara. So the Gemara says that Haman, being Memuchan, didn't prepare anything. So he didn't have enough supplies. So he asks Mordechai for supplies. So Mordechai says, well, okay, but on condition that you pay. He says, well, I don't have any money either. He says, that's okay, you can pay me by selling yourself to me as a slave. So he writes out a shtar in incisions on the sole of his shoe. Now, every time Haman walks by, Mordechai sits back and puts up the shoe and waves it. So not only does he not bow down, I mean, this would do Gilbert and Sullivan so proud. Not only does he not bow down, but there he goes and he's waving the shoe. So that he tells him every time, listen, I don't, really, don't complain. I mean, anything that you have, you understand, it's all mine. I mean, Eved Lemi, I mean, I bought you, I bought everything that you have. So this, of course, is going to infuriate him. So as the Gemara says, surely there must have been some issue here. So the way the Gemara puts it is that Haman had himself made into an Avodah Zarah, which the Malbim, I mean, the Medrash says that he actually would wear a cross or whatever, you know, whatever in those days, just to bedafka get on Mordechai's nerves. But the way the Malbim understands it, the whole issue in those days of providing a symbol of a Tsar that people are going to bow down to is ipso facto Avodah Zarah. It was all about a divine presence of some kind, some god type of god that was attached to it, and therefore Mordechai continued on the approach of Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. We don't bow down, sorry. It's part of our religion. Just a quirk. So by Yumravdi Amelach Asher Bishar Amelach Mordechai, Maduata Overet Mitzvat Amelach, how come you're not doing what the king says? Well, by ye ki omram, it should say it like we pronounce it. Elav yom v'yom v'lo shama lehem. They would say this to him every single day. Now that's interesting because, of course, there was another child of Rochel that every single day was presented with the same issue, as the Medrash points out. And that was vayhi kidabra el Yosef yom v'yom. So every single day she would speak to Yosef. So here too. And so they told Haman. So Haman goes over to him and says, now look, your great-grandpa, you're not better than your great-grandpa, are you? I mean, your great-grandpa was Yaakov. He bowed down to my great-grandpa, Esau. So what's the big deal? Says Mordechai, yes, but Binyamin wasn't there yet, you see. So because of that, you know, I'm from Binyamin. We really don't bow down. So that's all of this, of course, is just inclined to make him completely crazy. Vayar Haman ki ein Mordechai koreo mishtachaveh lo. So this the Malbim is medayik like this. What do you mean, vayar? He just told him. He had a conversation. He did let me show you. I mean, what do you mean, vayar Haman? So the Malbim says like this. They told Haman, the servants, they tell Haman, that, well, he's not bowing down. Because it's against his religion. And the only reason, you know, that people are bowing down is the religious symbol. He says, but I mean, how about if I am supposed to be honored? Well, but he's far away. It's when you walk by. I mean, over there. So therefore, they went to tell Haman to see whether Haman would come all the way up to Mordechai and watch his reaction. So he did. Vayar, and he sees, Kein Mordechai Koreim Ishtachar Alo, it's because of him. It's that personal relationship. Aha! And so, of course, Vayimale Haman Chema, and he gets absolutely infuriated with this. And so, Vayivez Beinav Lishlach Yad B'Mordechai Levado. After all, his great-grandpa was Vayivez Esav HaTapachorah, says the Medrash. It was all about looking down at the things that Yisrael stands for. And Yigidolo et Am Mordechai, he knew exactly what was going on. Vayivakesh Haman Lashmidit Kol HaYudim, Asher B'chol Malchut HaChashverosh, Am Mordechai, the people that he so cared about. So, B'chodesh HaRishon, Hu Chodesh Nisan, B'shnat 12, L'melech HaChashverosh, the time is really flying by here. We're already from the third year of his Malchut, 9 years later. It's the 12th year of HaChashverosh. He peeled poor Hu HaGorah L'fei Haman, so he does a lottery. Of course, the lottery is the symbol of randomness. Search for patterns that are not mechanical. The name of the holiday that ends up being created for some strange reasons, which means that that's the issue. The issue is the function of randomness, the relationship to randomness, and what Mimuchan would mean in the context of randomness. And so he does it miyom layom. Now you'll note that it says first miyom layom, and then it says b'chodesh l'chodesh. It's a funny way of doing things. That means that he did things separately. So first he goes to find the day. Now, this is taking place over here in Nisan, and he is trying to find the day in which, obviously, he wants to get this done as quickly as possible. And so he looks for the next possible day, so he starts doing days. But it goes to the last possible day, because we know that this whole thing takes place over Haman, Vayavam, over Pesach, and so on. So the last possible day is basically the 13th, because that's as far away as it could possibly get. From the day that he's doing the goal, which he, in other words, if he could do it tomorrow, it'd be great. Yeah. Okay, so it comes out on the 13th. Now, he's going to have to wait until the next 13th. He's thinking, well, that's a long time away, but maybe now we should worry about whether the month is really a month that is suitably mazel for me, for this kind of thing. So he does another goral in the month. The month comes out to be the furthest away possible month. So it's the last month. But at that point, he's very happy. Because, as the Gemara says, since the Goral fell out in the month of Adar, the Chodesh Remasar, Chodesh Adar, he was on the first month, it fell out in the last month. So the last month is the 12th month. He's very happy because he said, wow, that's great. This is the month in which Moshe died. That sounds a little bit weird. I mean, you know, it's like finding a yard site, not to say a tachana. You go into a Hasidic shul, there's always a yard site. There's whole calendars of how many yard sites this day has, just in case you need to find somebody that you remember the name, so you don't have to say tachana. So today is the yard site of... Okay, so... Alright, so it's the yard site of Moshe. So it comes out to be the last day of the Shiva of Moshe. And he thinks this is great. Now this sounds to us to be a little bit superstitious and silly. However, there's a very strange Gemara. The Gemara says, Gemara Chulin says, where do we see a remez to Esther in the Torah? Well, it says, Anochi haster astir et panai bayoma. And where do we see a remez to Mordechai in Atar? Mor dror, in this week's parsha, is targumed moridachia, which is moridachai, right? There you go. And where do we see a remez to Haman in the Torah? Oh, that goes all the way back to Gan Eden. Hamina eight, Sasha Amar, Hamin. Ah, that's Haman. And continues the Gemara, and where do we see Moshe min HaTorah? Where is Moshe min HaTorah? So, does Moshe really have something to do with the story? Well, remember that Moshe, of course, was the one who originally defeated Amalek. He was the one that allowed the milchama with Amalek to be won in a strange way. So, he was the one that translated the original milchama of Amalek into a question of consciousness instead of weaponry. That was Moshe. He's very happy. So we start, sounds weird, but the Gemara says, oh, he was absolutely right. Except the idiot forgot that Moshe Rabbeinu was died on the same day he was born. So therefore, it might as well be a holiday for Moshe. It's his birthday. And you know, this is in Harry Potter, they celebrate death days also. It's sort of Hasidim. So there shouldn't be any kind of question. So in that sense, really, it was a good day for the Jews. Now, what in the world does the death of Moshe have to do with what it was that Haman thought was a great occasion? Herein lies the main issue, believe it or not, of the entire Megillah. Why does Moshe die? Moshe dies because of the fact of Yan lo he'amantem me, when I told you v'dibarte v'la sela, and instead you hit the sela. So as the Medrash does, Rashi explains as a simple pshat in the pasuk. And what's the difference, really? I mean, it's pretty impressive whether you talk to the stone, abracadabra, or whether you tap on the stone with your magic wand. I mean, it's the same thing, isn't it? No, not the same thing at all. So as Rashi says, had Moshe spoken to the rock, then Klal Yisrael would have made the following brilliant kal vachomer. If a rock, which after all gets no reward for doing the right thing and isn't punished for doing the wrong thing, and nonetheless, when it's told to act in a way that is consistent with what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants, acts that way, we who, if we do the right thing, we are rewarded, and if we do the wrong thing, we are punished, alachat kama v'kama, that we should do the right thing. But no, he messed that up, and he hit the rock, which ruined the whole thing, and now he will have to die. Now, I mean, if anything is Gilbert and Sullivan-ish, that is it, right? I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous. You know, I always compare it to a guy who he works with computers all the time, you know? So he's become a total nerd. He can only think about the way he programs his computers. And he finally comes home one night, the kids don't go to bed, and he tells the kids, "Will you get into bed?" And they're jumping, swinging by the lamps, watching TV. And he says, I can't believe this. All day long, I give instructions to my computer, and it follows my instructions. Even though I rarely smash it to bits, and I don't reward it with anything, but it does follow my instructions. And you guys, for heaven's sakes, I'm so nice to you. If you follow instructions, I buy you lollipops. And if you don't, I whack you one. And you still don't follow instructions. At this point, of course, the kids are convinced the father has totally lost everything. And they call the insane asylum. I mean, where is he living? Obviously, the reason we don't follow instructions is because we're not computers. So how would anybody bring an idiotic kal vachomer from a rock with the very reason that the rock doesn't follow instructions? I mean, it doesn't get rewarded for following instructions because it doesn't follow instructions. It would just be programmed. Why would it get a reward? Now, obviously, the whole point of being human is it's a kal vachomer pircha. The very fact that you are rewarded is an indication that there's something to reward because you chose to do it. Therefore, I choose not to do it. It sounds totally crazy. For this, Moshe dies? You think that this is a small question. But Moshe Rabbeinu, on the day of his death, says, Hazinu shamayim v'adabera v'tishma haret simrei fi. And again, as Rashi says, brings this, just a love that, brings this from, again, all the same midrash, the same sifri. What was he saying? He was saying, look at the shamayim v'aret. Do they get rewarded when they do the right thing? Did you ever see them do anything different than they're programmed to do? And yet they get no reward and they get no onesh. So you who are, in other words, he's trying to teach this kal vachomer as his last brilliant move in life. Of course, it's nowhere near as powerful when it's just theory. Imagine how powerful it would have been had he spoken to the rock, huh? Something is very funny. Unless it represents a total departure from everything that we know about life and ends up relating to the nature of randomness and pattern. Because the truth is, shamayim v'aretz do not do what they're programmed to do. That's the crazy truth. We look at it always as there's just this mechanical thing, but it's not a mechanical thing. As Rashi says, well, look, you know, when you plant chita, does it bring up something else? Of course it does. I mean, there's mutations. Rare. So what you're really talking about is statistics. That's what you're really talking about. There are no rules that are absolute. Not for anything. The fact is, though, that we nonetheless construct a physics in which everything works. Because, I mean, it would be insane for it not to work, since it just, in terms of the short lifetime of the universe, the chances of an event happening, which would be so completely out of the norm, are just too small to consider. Nonetheless, if it happened, you think that if all the air in this room would suddenly go all the way to the other side, it's certainly possible. I mean, there's no law that it has to necessarily be all over the room. It's just statistically reasonable, since molecules are bumping into each other all the time, that they spread out. But certainly at one point we could all explosively decompress, because all the air in the room decided to move out the window, leaving Richie without his breathing machine, and then what would happen, and the rest of us without oxygen, if the mask on Purim drops, please put it to your mouth before attaching it to the one sitting next to you. And so, would the New York Times report an amazing miracle occurred in Jerusalem, where all of the people listening to the Api courses about it? No, they wouldn't report that. They would say, well, they said the chances of such a thing happening were only once in the lifetime of the universe. But unbelievably, it happened yesterday in Jerusalem in a small classroom in which blah, 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 blah. It would be a lovely end, but certainly nothing miraculous. It would just be weird. So, what's really happening, therefore, is that what Moshe Rabbeinu is saying is the fact is that there is no difference. It's interesting that Voltaire actually pointed this out. This is just an amazing thing, that all of nature, everything manages to work. But of course, there's only one thing in nature that does whatever it wants. Some silly biped about 5 feet high, which is a violation of all the laws of nature. And in these days, that's about how tall humans were. Yeah, there is something funny about that, actually, when you think about it. And that's exactly what the Kal Vachomer is saying. In other words, you have it all worked out. It's all mechanical. You're going to get exactly what you want. This is mamucha. I've got it worked out. And yet, the mechanics can end up being the very things which create the precisely opposite result of a pattern than the one you were looking for. Which is exactly what happens. That's the beauty of the Na'afel. It's not, as people think, sort of a midah k'neged midah to do the opposite in the mirror image. It's the fact that Haman is utilized precisely by taking all of his energy that he is dedicating for the cause of destroying Yisrael, down to the smallest detail, even the tree that he takes out of his own house, wrecking his ceiling in order to be able to make a nice show of killing Mordechai in order to make the nice show for killing himself. But every last detail puts in the woman, puts in the laws, creates the situation, engenders the psychological paranoia, tries to get rid of what's in the Sefer Divrei Hayamim, is the one that's been undoing Mordechai, which in the end the Haman sees as the really being aimed against, etc., etc. It's a crazy situation. He had it all worked out brilliantly, and it was absolutely successful. So successful that he's walking in with his head held high to finally get rid of his enemy at the very moment when he's about to be hung. So what Moshe Rabbeinu was essentially meant to say is the world is not mechanical and hitting a rock is a totally meaningless act. Exactly as meaningless. Oh, you think that I really hit a rock and that brings water out of the rock? I mean, that's pretty dumb. So for all intents and purposes, what we're dealing with is information. So talk to the rock. It's just as meaningful. Say to the rock, we need water. Watch the rock bring out water. Because that has nothing to do with what you did mechanically anyway. Now, you guys believe that, but that's not true about me. Really? Is that so? How about if we imagine that the underlying patterns of existence are totally non-mechanical and end up working out in a particular way just because they constantly get back to that strange attractor which makes them work out that way, as happens in many mathematical equations. How about that? You experience that all along as being them's the breaks. Sometimes you win on some of them and you lose some of them. Yeah, but how about if there were broader patterns in them's the break? How about if I could be so convinced that this were the reality of the underlying patterns that occur, the laws of nature, that I could say in a practical sense of how to lead my life, oh, Esther, of course don't go into the king to save us. Why would talking to a king be any more meaningful than talking to a rock? We don't need you to go to the king. Something will work out because it's a law of nature. Of course, that question is then, so why do anything? But that question could have been asked of Moshe too. So then why talk to the rock? That's a question that we will address when we finally get to the moment in which Mordechai says this to her. But that means the first time that in reality somebody acted out the Kal Vachomer of Moshe was Mordechai. He actually took it seriously. Now this, of course, drove everybody crazy. From the very beginning, he took it seriously. Every day, Kol Yom Vayom, remember? Mordechai mitalech lifnei chatzar. That Yom Vayom is coming up all too often. So Mordechai mitalech lifnei chatzar HaMelech, and he's walking in front of the Beit HaNashim. Ladat et Shlom Esther, ma ye'aseva. What do you mean, ma ye'aseva? Nothing. No, that's for sure not the case. The only question is, of course, that when you're dealing with random patterns, you can never be sure of anything. There's the old Heisenberg uncertainty. So he says that to Esther. Umi odea, I don't know. I mean, yes, everything adds up, but I certainly would never tell you with 100% certainty that that's the reason that you're in this position. Because by definition, if you know, you're back to mechanics. And this is all about poor, is it not? Now, the result of this poor, the reason that this poor is so central in dealing with the whole issue of Amalek, is because the attempt to utilize carry, which is the basis of poor, it means simple randomness, carelessness, in which there is no really specific reason for a particular sperm to have been utilized in an act of fertilization, and that's exactly what Bilam makes fun of. Well, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants tzaddikim, you know. Couldn't he breed for tzaddikim? So you're telling me that God sits there filtering sperm cells. Is that really the best he can do? That's literally what Bilam says, word for word. U'mispar rova Yisrael, sits there counting the ejaculations of Yisrael. And he makes fun of it, the Gemara says. And that's the strange punishment of Bilam, is that they found him boiling in a pot of sperm, of semen, for the rest of eternity. So this is not a small issue. This is metaphorically really central to an understanding of why life would be created in randomness, why we come to be through evolutionary process, why is everything just the toss of a die, Purim. That's the holiday. So when it comes out on the day of the death of Moshe, he realizes, Haman, that this is a serious issue. Because the one thing that a poor should do is come out on the day of the death of Moshe. After all, that's the one thing that actually did not successfully make it into the Todah of Yisrael, into the way that Yisrael works. You think that this is a small issue? Take a look back at the original Yerusha of Eretz Yisrael in Lech Lecha, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes the original bris with Avram, immediately after the First World War. And what happens over there? Oh, and this is like Rashi. So, Amalek shows up in Ein Mishpat. Hu Kadesh. Kadesh? Uh-oh, wait a minute, that sounds very familiar. But that's exactly where the rock was supposed to be spoken to. Yes, says the, that's why it's called Ein Mishpat. It was the place in which Moshe Rabbeinu was Nishpat. And that's precisely where it is that Amalek finds their Petah. So this idea of him seeing that what he is relates to the death of Moshe, to the Mishpat against Moshe, is very profound. And it's precisely why, by the way, today, Amalek is so dramatically successful against any religion. Because religion is always a set of beliefs that doesn't allow for randomness. It has everything worked out mechanically. Was the whole point of Purim, as Ayelat HaShachar, the Gemara says, means, is that it's the end of miracles. No more interference in nature. That was a primitive stage of Klal Yisrael's development.
Divine.
Certainly, there is no such thing as real interference. This is, by the way, so brought out beautifully in Tolstoy, in which it's almost the centerpiece of his whole understanding of the way that war and winning and Nitzochang, which is all about Netzach here, says people believe that they're actually having an impact. And when you take a look at the entire structure, it's so clear that just something is happening to them, not by them. And it brings this out again in actual speeches that generals are giving people. This is exactly how we experience reality. And that's indeed the Midah of Moshe is the Midah of Netzach. Discuss further why that's true. But you'll remember that when Shaul did not destroy Amalek and hoped that Shmuel would come back, Shmuel said to him, V'gam Netzach Yisrael, lo yishvakir, v'lo yinachir. Netzach doesn't lie. That's the ultimate sense of truth. The way things work out is linked to an underlying primal truth. And it's something that still needs to be discovered in human affairs. But it's exactly why Amalek is so brilliantly successful with anyone who would foolishly ignore the nature of war. We come now, he's carrying the new Beit HaMikdash, which is not going to have any elements of control in it, with him, happy that it's the time that Moshe Rabbeinu has died, thinking that that means that we are unable to deal with the world on the level of Hur, and goes into Lamelech Achashverosh and says, Yeshno amechad mefozar meforad bein ha'amim, בכל מדינות מלכותך, ודתיהם שונות בכולם, ודתי המלך אינם עושים, ולמלך אין שוב ולהניחם. So, Obviously, as the Gemara points out, look, there's no way that Ahasuerus didn't know who he was talking about, what he was talking about, and no way that Haman didn't realize that all he needed to do was give an excuse to get rid of the Jews. So that in the end, when Ahasuerus responds to his offer of paying all this money for the Jews, says, no, you keep the money. It's okay. So the Gemara says, you know what this is like? It's like two neighbors. One of them is dying to smooth out his property and start building. But he's got absolutely nowhere where he can get a license to dump the ground that he's going to have to dump in order to create his beautiful golf course. And he's looking at the neighbor, and the neighbor's got this tremendous hole that really he's let just sit there and never done anything with it. Darn it, if I could only just get myself the rights to dump there, but the guy would never allow it. The neighbor, of course, is thinking, oh man, wouldn't it be nice if I could have a nice, smooth property with a nice, beautiful yard? Oh yeah, I would buy that guy's hill over there and use it. And one day they meet each other, and one offers the other one money. He says, you kidding? Keep the money! Let's take it! Same thing is true over here. That's Ahasuerus. He's been waiting for an opportunity where finally someone will take the responsibility off his neck for getting rid of the Jews. Here, Haman offers the money. He says, you kidding? Money! Keep the money! Take the ring! the truth is we spoke about this earlier, but Ahasuerus is really the first Hitler type in which Ahasuerus, right. That's what he said. Yibime Ahasuerus's entire thing, beginning and end, has to do with Ahasuerus, the individual, what it is that he was trying to accomplish. He's the one that destroyed Babel. He's the one who wanted to destroy Babel. He wanted to destroy structure. He wanted to open up the possibilities of complete freedom. This was his idea of Shushan. He viewed the idea of the Beis HaMikdash and the Jewish conscience and all of the demands that were being made by the Jews, just as, I mean, everybody has analyzed through, you know, throughout the modern era. I mean, this is, you know, George Steiner wrote a beautiful essay called In Defense of Adolf Hitler, in which he explains the way in which the entire world has been destroyed by the Jews, and that this is the perception. That all concepts of freedom, the absurdity of believing that mankind is meant to be perfect and can achieve this grandeur, and the destruction that it has caused, and the way that the only way to really achieve freedom is to get rid of the Jews. He does it very cogently, which is exactly really what Ahasuerus couldn't articulate, but certainly was constantly aware of in attempting to destroy this opinion based on English. All the things that he went out of his way to show were unimportant to him. The Big De Kahuna and the Kiddat and the Kiddat Shel Terah and all of the other elements that we saw, the Kelim Mikelim Shonim. So when...
He's basically more Amalek than Haman.
No, he's not Amalek. Because he's looking for fun. And Amalek is looking for philosophy in the end. There's a big difference between the two. But he's more dangerous. In other words, the fact that he is looking for political and sexual freedom, the main point of Ahasuerus, this is not Haman's deal. What we really have over here is postmodernism as an ideal. It may be that, of course, the reason we'd like it as an ideal on a personal level is because it offers us a complete relaxation of any search for meaning or concern for meaning, an acceptance of the fact that there cannot be meaning, and that itself is meaningful. What else could be meaningful, after all? And, of course, that opens the door to anything that you want. But the fact is, it's far more from a philosophical point of view than what it is that Ahasuerus was interested. So you have over here a connection of the guy who's on the scene together with the philosopher who's behind the scene. So this is like basically Nazism is making use of Nietzsche and the philosophies that can allow you to develop a vision of life that that allows you to want to destroy the limitations that have prevented humans from truly becoming great. And that true greatness is getting beyond all of these concerns for good and evil, the development of Elam Hazeh in terms of an Elam Haba and so on, and it becomes a very powerful thing. Look, this is what the Nazis themselves spoke about, was their own godless, being able to reach a madriga at which they could actually kill men, women, and children, despite the fact that it's so painful to do that, for the betterment of the human species. And this is a tremendous mysterious nefesh, and they wrote about this. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, they recognize there's only one other genocidal society on earth, and that's the Jews. So the Timche Zecher Amalek and Taf Anashim B'Yom Echad is all very fundamentally interrelated as far as. And so there is Yeshno. Yeshno is a very strange way of saying things. In the one sense, it's a strong existential statement. They're always around and always making trouble. But it also has a double meaning in which it means sleep. And Yeshno means they are not really active right now. All of his discussion over here is a put-down on the current situation of Klal Yisrael. So by Chazal said, Yeshno Amechad, they're sleeping from the mitzvot. You don't have to worry about them. They have no achdut, especially Men Amechad. Look at them, Mufuzar Mufurad Ben Amin. They were thrown into Galut. They have themselves no internal structure. Scattered, B'chol Medinot Malchutecha. Dateyam Shonot Mikolam, some of the Mufarshim point out. Their religions. You know how many different religions they have? Every Gadol's got another religion in this. Yes, this rabbi, this will tell you one thing, yes, and another thing, a conservative reform. I mean, there's absolutely nothing that characterizes them as a consistent society. You put three of them together and they've got six religions. The only thing they're consistent about is that they'll never do what you want them to do. That's for sure. They always have to be different than anybody else. The other meaning of sleeping is that that's what they're always doing. They're always sleeping. You ask them, so how come the kids weren't in school today and nobody came to work? Oh, they say, today, oh, we have a holiday today, Passover. A couple of days later, well, you know, it's Shabbat today. Well, a little bit after that, well, we have a Shavuos holiday. You know, it's either Shabbos Hayom, Pesach Hayom, Sukkot Hayom. But, you know, when it comes to joining up in the Saturnalias, they're never around. So they don't keep the same holidays. They're constantly enjoying themselves in their own holidays, says the Medrash. Says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, oh, but yeah, you resent my holidays? Okay, I guess you'll be the source of another one. We'll make another holiday. So just as another cute Benahavahu. So they will not do what you want. So they're always got an excuse for why their religion is not going to allow them to do this, not allow them to do that, and they're not allowed to work today, and they're not allowed to attend church, and they're not allowed to attend the Mardi Gras or anything else. And they're mevazeyu. It's just not worth it for you to allow them to continue to exist. As the Gemara puts it, look, you have no idea. They could sit there eating and drinking, and underneath it all is such a profound putting down of the malchut. Let me tell you something. If a fly falls into a cup of wine, you think they'll throw out the cup of wine? Never. They'll throw out the fly. But if you touch the cup of wine, they'll throw out the cup of wine. Watch. Yeah, he's got a point. If the king will only write out a decree to get rid of them, well, that would be lovely. And I'll get the SS to collect enough golden teeth fillings to be able to bring all of that money to Ginzei HaMelech, the Osei HaMelech, I like that, the guys who do the work. And so, of course, this Aseret Alafim Kikar Kesev is the final blow in the Mishkan Beis HaMikdash issue, which is why we have Parsha Shkolim, always but immediately before Purim, in order to be Magdim, the issue of Kitisa and Havas HaShkolim, to Haman, because this too was clear that whatever the impact of money was meant to be in the creation of the Mishkan and in providing everyone an element of Mishkan, it's the one thing in the Mefarshim actually work out, the value of the Aseret Alafim in his terms is Keneged, the value of the Shkolim in the Mishkan. And so, this is why he gives it. It's the last stage of the Shonim, of the Bigdei Kahuna, of the Mokom that's Chotze the Malchus, of the Bira as opposed to the Bira. And so in the end, Vayasar HaMelech et Taba'atomi al Yado, the king takes off his ring, Vayitna, and gives it over, Lahaman ben Hamdata Hagagagi Tzorer HaYehudim. This is a pasuk that is meant to be exceedingly dramatic, so that I don't want to know anything, basically. The way Chazal view it is that Hasarat HaTabat was more important in terms of the impact it had on Yisrael than the words of all the Nevi'im throughout all of the generations that never could get these guys to move an inch. And all of a sudden, everything changes. All because it takes off a ring. Isn't that something? of course, from the Moloch's point of view, I will not put my signature on genocide. And this was all part of the original statement of Haman, where the king says, look, you know, I'd love to get rid of them, but you know what the history has been of people who've tried that. And this is what Haman starts responding to. Yeah. That's exactly what they were worried about, right? I think I mentioned earlier the interesting point of why he wanted to have all of them wiped out on one day. Did I mention it? Why was it Dafka Yom Echad? It was the Yom Echad. No, because if I lose, there was a clear-cut recognition, they'll only have 1 day holiday. If we do it over more, they'll make a 10-day holiday. And the response was, of course, to make Purim from the 13th and the 11th and all the way through. And that's why we give them so many different days to have a Purim on. But there is an awareness of that, as there was, of course, with Streicher's Purim Fest, you know. And there was the answers that the Gemara reads into the words of Haman, that no, you needn't worry, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given up on them, and they're Yoshenim in HaMitzvahs, and not only that, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu is now Yoshen on them. So, he says, Haman says they have Tzadikim, and there's not all like that, and rather HaKashverah says, I'm worried about the Tzadikim. Haman answers, Am Echad, they have one is responsible, all of them responsible for each other, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of hashkafa discussion over here about whether Achashverosh should really do this. In the end, Achashverosh says, okay, look, I mean, but what are people going to say? You know, I mean, they're going to call us genocidal. To which Haman says, well, look, it's not as if there's any central area of Jews. I mean, everybody's going to be happy to get rid of the Jews. It's not that there's one place where they're going to be able to use this as propaganda against you. You don't have the allies that are going to turn against you and make a Nuremberg trial. You're the leader of everything. And they're b'chol medinot malchutecha. They don't have a particular place. So what the heck? Nonetheless, he doesn't want to fix his name to it. So what does he do? He gives over the Tabat. And the decree he leaves open, which of course is part of the whole idea of anything could happen, but which becomes part of the very use in the end of the chaos of what could be. Because what did he say? He wrote a letter. First he says, Vayomer HaMelech LeHaman, HaKesev Natun Lach, you keep the money. And Ha'am LaSor Po Ketov Beinecha, you do what you want. You just take care of it and don't involve me. So as the Rabbanan said, Achashverosh hated the Jews more than Haman. You could see from here. Because normally, somebody who is making a deal, and supposedly Haman's the one who's trying to buy and so on. So it's the buyer who's going to give a down payment to the seller. So why did he come along, take off his ring, and give it to Haman? Well, it's exactly the opposite. Haman should have taken off his ring and given it to Achashverosh. Said, when I pay you the Aseret Alafim, you know, you'll give it back to me. Instead, it's clear from the beginning that he views this as his great opportunity. So before they even make the deal, he said, take the ring. And then he gives back the money, and then he gives over the Amsa. It's clear. This is a fantastic opportunity. I can't do it myself, but I'm so glad that there's someone here that can. So that HaKesev Natun Lach, and of course the Medrash points out that HaKesev is the Gematria Ha'et, meaning you just hung yourself. So HaKesev Natun Lach, and you do what you want. Vayikaru Sofrei HaMelech V'Chodesh HaRishon B'Shalosha Asar Yom Bo. So now it is actually the, as we see from here, that Pur was the latest possible time. Because this is the first month, so it fell out in the 12th month. This is the 13th, which is the last day. Had it been in that month, he wouldn't have been able to use it. It was too late. So it's now the 13th day, so that it's 2 days before Pesach. Vayikatev kechol asher tziva Haman, and they wrote everything that Haman had commanded to Achar Shtar Pnei HaMelech, v'yal ha'pachot asher al-medina, v'yal sarei am va'am. To each one in its language, medina umdina kichtava va'am va'am kiloshono, b'shem ha-melech ha-kashverosh, he wrote it in the name of the king, nichtav, so it was written, and was sealed with the tabat ha-melech, but he didn't write anything incriminating. Because as we shall see, all he wrote was, liyot atidim liyom hazeh, be ready for this great day. Be ready for what? It was because he never said what it is you're supposed to be ready for that in the end, although the rules are you cannot call a letter back, as Achashverosh says to Esther, well, what do you want me to do? We already sent out the letters. Said Esther, oh, no, I don't want you to take back the letters. I think those letters are wonderful. You wrote for everybody to be ready to be killed on that day by the Jews who will be seeking their vengeance. Oh, couldn't I just bring the letters back? No, you're not allowed to bring the letters back. You have to just finish what it was meant to say. So writing these letters in this non-incriminating fashion was the reason that it ended up being v'nahavachu. And here, that ambiguity strongly expressed, not only in the nature of these letters, because let's take a look. Here on the surface, what we have are letters that are supposedly going to make it clear that Nishlachs v'nishlach svarim b'yad haratzim alko b'niot hamelech lahashmid laharog ulabed. Absolutely wipe out. Et kol ha-yudim minar ve'atzaken taf v'nashim b'yom echad v'shlosha asar l'chodesh nemasar hu chodesh adar u'shlalam lavos. Now, that's very strange, because here it says that the letters contained the fact that these people are meant to be all wiped out in a very specific day at a specific time, men, women, and children, and yet the very next line says, Patshegen haktan. Now, Patshegen, that's something that we saw a lot in Daniel, and it's interesting that here, the Medrash goes out of its way to say, what is Pachegen is antigraphon. Antigraphon. That's the word that's used in the Medrash. Now, antigraphon is Greek, and as the word implies, antigrapho. It means a Xerox copy. So that is the anti of the graphos that was there originally. So what it's saying is that the copies of the letter that were sent out didn't say anything of the sort. In fact, linatein dat b'chol medina u'medina golui l'chol ha'amim. That which was open to all of the people was merely lihiyot atidim l'yom hazeh, to be prepared. Prepared for what? No idea. As the Medrash puts it, umot ha'olam nevuatan situma. I mean, lihiyot atidim l'yom hazeh, enam yodim im laharog im lahareg. Be prepared for death or be prepared for murder. Aval Yisrael nevuatan mefureshet lihiyot ha'yudim atidim l'yom hazeh lihinakei mi'oyveihem. Same words, but it ends with a definition. And so, indeed, the attempt, now, what did this mean? Did it mean that, as far as was galui l'chol amim, as opposed to between the lines? Is that what it means? Perhaps, some learn that way. In other words, the message that people were getting is, there's only one meaning to this kind of thing. It's fun day. Shoot the Jews up, boys. Open season. The kind of thing that you would have in, you know, rabidly anti-Semitic communities in the U.S. It'd be the same kind of thing. If they got a letter like this, we know what it's all about. You know? But the Malbim here, too, has a fascinating approach. He says, look, there's clearly two letters. There's the letter that's galui l'chol amim, and then there's the letters that were sent out, which were nichtav. Nechtam b'tabat ha-melech. Nechtam b'tabat ha-melech doesn't mean the modern sense of nechtam b'tabat ha-melech. Then on the bottom of the page it had the king's stamp. It means that the envelope was sealed, which it meant until very recently. The sealing ring was a sealing ring, which meant, says the Malbim, the instructions for the 13th of Adar came, do not open, as is very common, which is in all diplomatic missions, do not open them. Yeah. It's very common. So that what he did was he sent out two letters, levels of letters. He sent out one level where the people in the know would be able to start the propaganda against the Jews, to get people aware of the fact that the Jews are horrible and so on, have them connected in their own mind, you know. Or, according to their Malbim, they wouldn't really know until the moment came, and then of course you could always issue another letter which would prevent them opening that letter and reading this letter. But that part of the letter wasn't binding. So all that was done was left open. And once it was sent, you can't return it. So you need to define it. Well, how are you going to define it if you don't want to kill the Jews? The only thing you can say is, for the Jews to kill. Basically, the Nahapachu is built in now to this. But again, it's the preservation of ambiguity that is so important in this story. Haratzim yatzu d'chufim bidvar ha-melech. And so the king has them sent out immediately. Vadat nitina b'shushan ha-birah. But of course, nobody knows what it means, as we see in the closing of the pasuk. V'amelach ve'aman yashvu lishtot v'ayir shushan navocha. What do you mean, navocha? Navocha means confused. What in the world is this all about? It's only in the next pasuk, which we begin the next so-called perek, Mordechai yadat kol asher nasa. So it's Mordechai who knows. We all kinds of, so how did Mordechai know? Whatever. Eliyahu HaNavi came to tell him, says the Medrash. Or says Rashi, the Bala Chalomot was Megalat. Well, whatever it is. I mean, obviously, on the political level, Mordechai is well connected and has all kinds of ways of knowing things. I mean,
he read Tom Friedman's column in the New York Times.
In the middle of Esther, when we're learning about Haman, we got to remember Thomas Friedman. At the end, towards the end, is when we should remember. So, but clearly, ambiguity was the name of the game throughout this whole thing. Now, do you want to see to what amazing extent ambiguity is the name of the game? This is it. So the Talmidim, ask Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, they ask him, why was Klal Yisrael roy to be wiped out in this? I mean, this was a real gezeira. And unfortunately, we've seen that gezeiras like this actually happen. They're not just games. So what was this all about? What could have possibly justified this? So he says to them, you tell me. Very interesting remark. What? You tell me. So they say, well, it seems to follow along with the fact that they were nene misu'udato shel Torah shah. They went to the party, and whatever, yayin nesach, and the whole idea, no. So he says that if that's the case, only the locals should have been affected. Why was it a universal decree against all of the Jews? So they said, okay, so now you said. So he says, well, mipnei shishtachavu mitzelem. Now, of course, this is going all the way back to Nebuchadnezzar. Amazing. In other words, Mordechai is taking a stand. We have to understand what this means. I'll get to it in a moment, but he's taking a stand because of something that had happened. I mean, so much, we're in the 10th year of Achashverosh. We have to go all the way back to before Koresh and before Belshazzar and get to the story of the crazy Maisa with the Tselem that was, I mean, this is nuts. That was his vision that became so central in Daryovich's time. But that idea of, you know, we all have to bow down. Because of that, and amazingly, they didn't kill Mordechai. I mean, Lomaisa, the Gemara says, Mordechai is called a Yudi, and Mordechai is called Yemini. Which one was it? So going to one shot in the Gemara. It's Klal Yisrael bemoaning the fact that this man exists. If only, look at what Yehudi did. Who was the Yudi? Dovid HaMelech. He should have killed Shimi ben Gera on the spot. Mordechai is ben Shimi. So it's because he let Shimi survive that we have to deal with this nut. Who's going to get us all knocked off? And Ma'asali Yemini, why is it called Yemini? Because it's his Yemini, the Binyamin part, that allowed Agag to survive. Put Shimi and Agag together, and you get Mordechai and Haman just a few, 5 centuries later, and look what they've done to us. That's amazing. Yeah, unbelievable. So, I mean, speaking of the historical flow, I mean, the historical awareness, it's just beautiful. So this is Klal Yisrael complaining, but that means that essentially they were actually responding to this kind of thing. I mean, Rav Dessler points out, can you imagine when it is so clear, he compares it to the Holocaust, we're going on, you know, the rabbis never know, what they're talking about, they're getting us all killed off, and so on and so forth. Here's a guy that is clearly doing everything wrong to destroy Klal Yisrael, and telling them, instead of what is obvious, that he's being ma'arer the umais against them, and he's a rebbe, and all the things that everybody sees are 100%, you have no right to do this, and he's telling them, no, you forget, like 20 years ago, 15 years ago, did anybody say anything about that Tselem? That's what it's all about. And then when he gets them to do teshuva in the, during these days now, during Tzanitas, they respond to him instead of killing him? That's an unbelievable thing that people should be able to accept a person like this. Now, of course, even at the end of the Megillah, he doesn't necessarily have all that many friends. Ratzei l'rov echad. Seems to be an awful lot of people are not too happy with him, as the pasuk itself points out. But he's in a very delicate position himself. And indeed, Mordechai yada, as the Mefarsha point out, and he realized it's all because of him. But this is what he was being choter to. Now, what's amazing is the closing of this discussion. So the Talmidim say to Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, look, I mean, the way we were learning, it's a gezeira, and you could be nitzo from this gezeira because it was a gezeira that was a reaction to something that's not a chiyuv mita. But according to the way you're explaining it, then we're mishtachav al etzelem, v'chimasu panim yesh b'davar. But I mean, so God just, okay, fine. We're just playing a game. Now, note the words, masu panim, is no se panim lecha. I'll forgive you, right? Amar Lahem, he says to them, well, Heim lo asu ela lefanim. They just did it on face value. They didn't really mean it. Af HaKadosh Baruch Hu lo asa imayim ela lefanim. He didn't really mean it. Sheneh b'hayinu dechtiv ki lo anam libo. He didn't plan this out in his heart. It was a game. That means that the entire story was ambiguous in the most profound way. So the Gezerah in the Shemaim was ambiguous. And why is that? Because the Aveda of the Tselem was ambiguous. And therefore Mordechai's reaction was linked to that ambiguity, to the extent that Pesach has to explain, as we go back in the sugya about the Nebuchadnezzar statue itself. So what the Rabbeinu Tam explains over there is that Tselem of Nebuchadnezzar, you will recall, is not truly Avodat Kohavim. It was a political statement. Political in the sense of malchut. In other words, it was meant to be, you remember the scene, the orchestra that comprised the players from all over the world, the international symphony, and the moment that the symphony plays the absurd constant refrain about, and as the drums and the violins and the cymbals, so on and so forth, right? Remember that? And everybody has to bow down and so on. But it just seemed, I mean, it was the same tones that you get here in Megillas Esther. It was the background to this Gilbert and Sullivan play. Exactly the same tones. And nonetheless, says Rabbeinu Tam, so it was L'chvod HaMelech, okay? And therefore, it's really true that Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, the godless of Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, that they weren't Mishtachav El Tzelem, was that it was completely Bifnim Mishurat Adin. They were allowed to be Mishtachav to this Tzelem from a purely political point of view if the Melech is standing there and mitzvahing them to do it. And yet, he says, that explains why the Gemara says that had Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah been tortured, they would have bowed down to this Tzelem. Says Tosfos, I mean, that's crazy. That's been throughout the generations. So many people have stood up to torture, not to bow down to Avodah Zarah. But Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, Dafka were only able not to be Mishtachaver because it was only death, not physical torture. And Reb Hananiah ben Tradion was wrapped in a Sefer Torah, wouldn't give in, and burned alive. What's the Chiddush over here? So clearly it must be that it wasn't really Avodat Kohavim. And that's even if you listen to what Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah tell Nebuchadnezzar, is they say to him, Le'elohach let anan palchi. We don't worship your God. And Le'tzalmech let anan segidim. We refuse to bow down to your statues. Clearly, says Tosfos, mashmah d'tray milia. These were two separate issues. What that means is that when we're talking about Yehudi being called Yehudi because he's kofer b'avodat kohavim, or because he's yechidi, and it says he's miyached shmo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'olam, what he was doing was indeed entirely shelo kafi, what was required la'aloch. But the entire thing was built around the devastation of relying on the halach. That's exactly what Rav Shimon HaYochai is saying. There is a time in which the context of things becomes so definitive that although it's secular, the secular becomes a religion. And if you'll notice, Purim is a completely secular holiday. Because of this, the point is that it's meant to deal with the interrelationship of the panim, the panim that are on things, the facade, literally the face on things, and what is happening inside. Mordechai recognized that it was the bowing down to that Tzelem that remarkably, as Rav Shimon Bar Yochai pointed out, was the equivalent in the realistic effects of what it would do to Klal Yisrael, was the equivalent of Avodah Zarah. Why does this happen? Becomes clear only, and I'm going to jump ahead because we need to see that next pasuk. In Mordechai Yada, we've already spoken about the first part. Vayikra Mordechai et Begada vayibash sak va'efer vayetze betoch ha'ir vayizak zeaka gedola umara. Now that vayizak zeaka gedola umara, Chazal remarkably show us that the place where it says this, or the only other place, is Esau. He comes out of that room, into that room, as Yaakov left, Vayitzak Tzaka Gidola Umara. And Paralo B'Shushan, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, paid Yaakov back in Shushan, Sheneemar Zaka Gidola, Vayitzak Tzaka Gidola Umara, exactly the same language. L'lamdach Hashem Vatranut, Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Everything counts. Now what counts here? What counts? The Vayitzak Tzaka Gidola Umara, was exactly the issue that fooled everybody about the Nazis. Because the reason that there was no reaction to the Nazis, even though they were publicly proclaiming they were not ambiguous, their intent to destroy Israel, was because every time that had happened, you could buy your way out. And it was for that reason that Jews, in fact, provided the financial backing for Hitler, because that's always the way in which you gain influence. The amazing thing about the Nazis is they couldn't be bought. And that's exactly what this Megillah is about. That's why money is so important. The entire relationship between Yaakov and Esau